You've tuned in to the PDU Podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The PDU Podcast brings together industry experts and seasoned professionals to discuss topics in the assessment and management of the pediatric patient in the out-of-hospital environment. You can interact with us at pd-u.com, on Twitter at PDU, email us at podcast@pd-u.com, or call us at 716-245-5336. Hello and welcome to the PDU Podcast, your, well, almost bi-weekly podcast of everything, well, small and pediatric. My name is Kyle David Bates, and we're here with a great panel this evening. And I'll tell you, I kind of got this idea. Yes, I live in the Great White North. I live up here in Buffalo, it's going to be one of these nights. Buffalo, New York, where I grew up playing hockey. Yes, ice hockey, none of this roller hockey stuff, none of this floor hockey stuff. Ice hockey is what I've been playing. And we ended up getting ready to go on the ice one night, and we're changing, and I kind of see a kid being carried down the hallway on the shoulder. I'm like, oh, there's probably a knee injury. And a worried mother comes to our dressing room. Of course, you have to imagine this. It's a bunch of half-naked grown men, and here's a mom opening up our door. It's like, hey, how you doing? And she looks at us and goes, where's the closest urgent care center? So some of our guys were really nice and started to tell her where it was. But she had this look of concern on her face. And I'm like, what are you looking to go there for? She goes, I think my son has another concussion. I'm like, another concussion? How old is he? He's 13. I said, well, let me walk on down and take a look at him. So I go walking into the locker room and basically all my gear. I'm a goalie, so just look at all the gear I have. And he was this 13-year-old boy sitting on a bench, just kind of out there. Lights are on, but really no one's home. I start talking to him, and his responses are kind of slow. I start doing an assessment on him. And he's not really making good eye contact. He's just kind of staring off into space. So I go down his head. The head's atraumatic, and he's got some neck pain. He's got some back pain on that. And I start talking to him, and I'm starting to realize that he's really kind of slow to respond with his responses. So I ask mom what happened, and one of the coaches says that he went down in the corner and took a knee to the head, and and they got his head smashed into the boards. And I asked, was there a loss of consciousness? And they're like, no, he was talking when we got there. And I asked mom, you mentioned another concussion, and she says, well, yeah. I said, well, how many? She goes, it's his fifth one. He had a grade 3 concussion back in November, which is about 3 weeks prior to this head injury. And I found out later on that the injury wasn't immediate. He didn't come off right after the injury. He had been sitting on the bench for pretty much a third of the game. And it wasn't until the game was over that they decided to take him off and into the locker room. And I start to think about how we're getting a lot more injuries with sports, a lot more traumatic injuries and heads. And I know with hockey has been a big concern, football there's been a big concern in concussions and head injuries. So with that, I kind of wanted to use that as our basis for our talk tonight on pediatric brain injuries. And I got a great panel on with me. I have Dr. Lou Romig, my partner in this process. How are you today, Dr. Romig?
Good evening. I'm doing just fine.
How are things down there in Florida?
Nice and warm.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're still
I have to rub it in.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming.
Always a pleasure.
Dr. Peter Antevi, how are you? Mute button.
Hello.
There you go.
Hey, Kyle. How are you? I'm doing
good. Thanks good. And you're also down in the Florida area, too, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Oh, must be nice. Well, welcome. And, of course, last we here have is Russ. Russ, how are you?
Not a doctor.
Not a doctor. A medic. And not from Kentucky.
No, not from Kentucky either.
From Tennessee, correct?
Close? Yeah, that's where I'm living right now.
That's where. Okay, gotcha. Well, welcome, Russ.
Thank you.
All right, so let's put that out there. You know, I have this kid who's, you know, if it was a cartoon, he'd have the little birdie going around the top of his head. Is this something that we're starting to see more and more of?
Well, I guess I'll start by saying that we see this very frequently nowadays in the emergency department, and I'm sure that you all are seeing it more frequently than we are in the pre-hospital environment, because you guys are at the game, at those games and so forth. This is becoming really a significant problem, in my opinion, in pediatrics.
Now, it's funny that you said that. You see these in the ER, but how many of these injuries do you think that you never see until they're bad?
Yeah, I think that that number is really high, and unfortunately, I have to say that that's probably not just a coach problem, but I think it's also a parent problem, and thirdly, an athlete problem. I think that's the order that it goes in, and we really have to educate those folks in the right thing to do.
And, you know, I'll tell you what, that the coaches and the trainers, fortunately, are really being pretty assertive about bringing the newer guidelines into play. And the athletes themselves, I think, are in a lot of times feeling pressured not to tell the trainers and the coaches exactly how they're feeling because they don't want to be pulled out of the game. And that's happening more and more under the new guidelines. So I think that the factor of the athlete themselves not necessarily owning up to what they're feeling is probably even creeping up the line of problems.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. I mean, I think that the pressure nowadays for success in sports, I think has grown. I hope that the media hype of concussions and all the new data that we're reading about and hearing about is finally starting to creep through and make a difference.
Russ, do you guys do standbys where you are?
We do not. And I was actually getting ready to comment about that. Is that what about those injuries that we're not seeing in younger children with those like Pee Wee football leagues and stuff where there are no, you know, trained medical providers there to assess those kind of injuries. So it's, you know, quite possible that with the pressure that Dr. Ntebe was talking about, that we may be seeing it in younger and younger children and it not being recognized.
That's true. And we, you know, we're talking sort of starting out talking about the sports-related head injuries, but it seems like every kid, you know, falls and hits their head at some point, even early on in their life as they're first starting to walk and learn to negotiate very well. And you know, we tend to think in terms of concussion and limitation of activities and that kind of thing in the older kid who is engaged in organized athletics. But you're right, Russ. We really do need to think about the younger kids, not only in the organized sports, but also just the ones who just hit their heads under the usual everyday kind of activity. And you don't generally like to think about a two-year-old, say, having a concussion, but there's nothing to say that they don't have exactly the same type of brain injuries that those athletes don't or do.
Now, that's really interesting because I always kind of joke is that my son has been cerebrally damaged since he started learning to walk because I could take a table, put it at the 50-yard line in an empty football field, put him in the end zone. And when he was learning to walk, he would find that table with his forehead.
Well, cocktail tables or coffee tables are a nemesis to society, as far as I'm concerned.
He hit everything. I mean, went over around. He went headfirst into it. How do we? Wow, I never even thought about that type of injury at uh-huh. that age. And my kid, well, maybe that explains a lot. My son, sweet kid. But
funny though, you know, Kyle, if I could just stop there because I think it's very interesting that the parent, from the parent's perspective, they don't really look at that head injury as a kind of as an additive injury, as an injury that could lead to other issues down the line. They're so hung up on that, you know, I need a CAT scan because I want to make sure my kid doesn't have this kind of deadly epidural hematoma that it seems like most parents kind of miss the point because they want the test that will give them an answer to how their child is doing. But we're realizing more and more now that those injuries are really additive. And yes, I agree with you, Lou, and everybody else, that these could start with Russ as well. These can start at a younger age and become additive. And these are causing a lot of different problems that you can't really test for, per se, although there are some tests coming out for them.
So,
just to say, talking about additive, all the CT scans that the parents demand,
right,
and if people give into them, those are additive too.
Yes.
So you have additive head injuries, and then you have additive radiation exposure. So, you know, we're doing it double bad.
It's like playing football at Love Canal.
There you go.
Now, I guess maybe we should go back a little bit and kind of start talking about, you know, you're mentioning the CAT scan. Like, well, why does that not matter? What are we looking at? And I guess this is all, I guess concussion syndrome falls under traumatic brain injury?
Yes.
Okay, so what is the definition of a traumatic brain injury, or TBI?
Well, I don't happen to have it right in front, but at any time you have, okay, trauma, there's trauma involved, the brain is involved, and there's an injury. And it's an injury that would have a potential for having ongoing complications or affecting the future life of the person. And those effects can be so very subtle that it's very difficult to discern whether there's something going on, whether it's related to a past head injury or not. Who knows? Everybody that's out there that's been diagnosed with ADHD or ADD or learning deficits, you know, someday we might find out that they all got dropped on their head at some point, and somebody's going to say, okay, it's because of a head injury. But it's almost to that point, because the signs and the symptoms can be that subtle. But it's hard to tie them back to what may have been the initial inciting event. But yeah, a TBI, people that, oh, traumatic brain injury is something big and dramatic. No. A lot of times it's really, really subtle. Yeah.
So TBI is more of a generalization.
It's head injury. Term. It's a new term for head injury.
Head injury. Now, and concussion falls under that?
Concussion is a form of traumatic brain injury. That's correct.
Okay. So why would you not see something, a concussion, on a CT scan?
Because concussion is based on brain function, not on brain structure. On a regular CAT scan, you can't see brain function. All you can see is the brain structure. So you can have a concussion and not show anything on the CT because there's no disruption of the brain tissue. There's no hemorrhage that's, you know, big enough to be able to show up on the CT. There's no swelling with shift of structures. So a CT only shows you structure and not what the actual neurons are doing or not doing at the cellular level. And that's what determines a concussion.
Right. And that's, I think, what the biggest problem is, that when you have a CAT scan that is told to the parent to be quote unquote normal, then they think, oh, everything's normal. But I really think that it's the same analogy, I think, is for the level of CO2 in your system. You know, people will look at a kid who's breathing 3 times a minute, who's got 100% O2 sat, and say that person's fine, but not realize that the peak CO2 is climbing. It's the same thing with head injury. Because we can't really quantify it, it's hard to say to somebody, your child has this level of injury, per se.
And that's not to say that at some point in the future there might not be some markers, so blood tests that can be done to determine, you know, levels of cellular damage, which would then influence future function. And I'm sure there's a lot of research going on to try to determine those kind of markers. But at this point, you know, just taking pictures of the brain doesn't really tell you anything about what the actual injury to the brain might be, and what is, you know, what's in store in the future.
And actually, Lou, when I was in Pittsburgh, and I think that there's a lot more research on it now. They have it's a blood test called the S100B, and that's actually a marker of brain injury that they were using to determine whether or not a child had shaken baby syndrome, and it's one of those markers that they are using now. So you never know. There may be that one day where we in the ER or the neurologist may say, let's go check your S100B level to determine how bad your concussion is. And then people will take it more seriously, I think.
Didn't the University of Pittsburgh also develop a kind of a function test?
Yes.
Know the NFL adopted it. Is there any research into using a similar test for pediatrics?
The only thing with that test is that what they did was they had kids sit in front of a computer, and they did all these kind of testing to see how quickly they can react and so forth. And in Pittsburgh, they took all the student athletes before they went on the field, and they had a baseline number for those children. After they got a head injury, they brought them back into the lab, put them back in front of that computer program every single day, and they realized that it took them approximately 14 days to come up to their actual baseline number after that one head injury. So it is an actual great, just like Lou was saying, it's a function test rather than a picture. That is the picture.
So how, besides mechanism, how would we start to suspect or assess for a possible concussion in a pediatric patient?
symptoms, and the symptoms are reflecting the function of the brain at that point. So you assess at the time of the injury, you assess it, you know, as time goes by past the injury to see whether symptoms are there, new symptoms are coming, old ones are going away, anything is getting worse. And I'm trying to get my article to list the signs and symptoms. Give me just a second and I'll find that.
You could look at things like memory, whether or not a child can follow basic commands. But remember, all this is being done on the side of a football field where the crowd is cheering, the parents are up in the stands, and there's 10 minutes left in the game. And we have to hope that those people on the sidelines are really up to speed with what really all the latest information is, and not to put those kids back in so quickly.
I think a lot of times, you know, we see that pressure. You see it a lot in high school sports. You see it a lot in, like, junior hockey. I'll tell you, I even see the competitiveness in the young kids' sports as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, the parents are living vicariously through the kids. And, you know, it's not doing the kids any great favors. Let's talk a little bit about the signs and symptoms of concussion. And this is from September 2010. This is a clinical statement, a clinical report, sports-related concussion in children and adolescents, released by the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Sports Medicine and Fitness. And Kyle, I sent you that link, so once we post that on the website, anybody can access this article. But in general, the signs and symptoms of concussion are divided into four basic categories: physical symptoms, cognitive symptoms, emotional, and then sleep disturbances. So, anybody care to guess at what kind of physical symptoms? What do we see the most commonly? Anybody?
I see, like, a nausea, vomiting.
Yep. Nausea, vomiting, headache, problems with balance, changes in the vision, just feeling tired, being sensitive to noise, being sensitive to light, you know, that kind of dazed or stunned kind of affect. Those are all some of the physical symptoms that you can get with concussion. And this is either at the time of the injury itself or as the concussion, the injury, you know, continues and the patient is removed from the time of the injury but still suffering consequences. So then the cognitive symptoms can include just that foggy feeling. Your brain just feels all foggy and you can't concentrate. You feel kind of slowed down. Might have trouble remembering. So it's not just the amnesia at the time of the event, but also as you're going in school for the next, you know, days to weeks. Are you having trouble remembering things from class? Forgetting recently acquired information. That's called anterograde amnesia. Remembering stuff that's already happened is retrograde amnesia. And then the inability to continue to remember things as they happen is called anterograde. And it's generally thought that anterograde amnesia is a little bit worse prognostically than retrograde. So you get the kid been hit on the head and he says, "What happened? What happened?" You tell him what happened, and then 2 minutes later he's going, "What happened? What happened?" So he can't maintain the information that you've just given him, and that's called anterograde amnesia. Confusion, questions being answered slowly, repeating questions, those are cognitive symptoms. Emotional symptoms, you probably haven't even thought about this. Somebody who has a head injury, a cheerleader who's a Flyer was not caught by her bases and she fell on her head. All of a sudden she's, you know, she's cranky, she's sad, she's more emotionally labile than usual. Okay, yeah, it could be PMS, but it could be her concussion as well, or just being nervous. And then just sleep disturbances can be signs of concussion as well. So sleeping more than usual, sleeping less than usual, having trouble falling asleep, having trouble staying asleep, those can all be symptoms of concussion. And you see, they're very nonspecific. It would be easy to attribute that to depression. It's very similar to some of the symptoms of depression. So it's going to be a matter of being aware of what's happened to the child, keeping in mind, oh yeah, he was playing basketball and I remember he came in and he said that he took an elbow to the head and he was just kind of stunned for a minute.
Yeah, you know, Lou, I think that's all those are great that you mentioned, and especially the ones that, you know, how many kids do we see coming to the ER who have these psychiatric issues and they've been Baker-acted? And recently we had a kid who just wanted to kill himself, and the parents said to me, you know, he used to be the best student and everything. And oh, by the way, this kid was a football player and the parents can count how many times this kid has had a concussion, and it just kind of makes you think, hey, is it possible that this kid, over time, became this bad that he's ending up in our room in the ER that has got soft walls and it's got a lock on it with a camera? I mean, that's the state of affairs. So think about that.
That was my concern with this 13-year-old. My mom tells me that this kid, this is the 13th or the fourth or fifth concussion that he's had, and he had one just 2 or 3 weeks prior. It was a grade 3 concussion. Now, is that considered a bad concussion? What's it called, a grade 3?
Well, a grade 3, there are so many concussion grading systems, and from what I've been reading, none of them have truly been validated. They're sort of proprietary systems that people just put together. But grade 3 is generally thought of in most of the systems to be either the most severe or the next to the most severe. The problem with the child that you're talking about is possible second impact syndrome, which is where you can get a concussion and then you have a second concussion while you still have symptoms of the first one. And that increases the chance of intracranial bleeding and significant complications of that second head injury. And then there's also the multiple impact kind of thing, like Muhammad Ali. It's thought that Muhammad Ali's Parkinsonian type symptoms and syndrome may be due to being hit in the head so much when he was a fighter. And if he had not been a fighter, he might not have bad Parkinson's disease. So there have already been cases of high school athletes who've had documented multiple concussions, at least one of whom who died, I think as a result of some neurological thing, and on autopsy basically showed the same kind of findings as the athletes, the pro athletes, who died long after their careers were ended but who had neurological compromise. You know, this teenager showed exactly the same kind of thing in his brain, presumably from repeated head injuries. That's stunning, huh?
That's just, you know, you're starting to wonder if playing all those sports and stuff is really worth it in the later run. You know, you look at how many kids play sports with the hope to go on to college and the professionals, and actually how many really make it that way. And it galled me to see that this kid was back playing hockey that soon after such a severe head injury. I think that the parents have to kind of, you know, hop up and start saying, you know, you're not playing him, and be the bad person.
Yeah, but it's a system failure. And as with system failures, you know, there are multiple links in the chain that can either hold that kid together or allow him to fall apart. So, yes, the parents have to play an active role, but they can't play that role unless they're given the right information to be able to say, all right, you know, here are the benefits of continuing doing that kind of sport, because maybe he's really good at it and we need a college scholarship because that's the only way this kid is going to go to college, versus, okay, here are the medical risks, and these are things that could affect your child adversely for the rest of his life. So there's always risk versus benefit ratios there, but parents can't put their foot down if they don't know that they should put their foot down. And it's up to all of us in the medical profession to be able to make that information available. And of course, with the internet, there's so much more availability of really, really good resources out there. But, you know, I've already said that recent studies say that all these concussion grading scales probably aren't valid. They haven't been validated. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. Published information on head injuries in the last 2 to 3 years, there's been a really radical change from, okay, the old grade 1 concussion, they can go back to play within 15 minutes if they have no symptoms, to now guidelines, any concussive symptoms, you don't go back again to contact sports in that same day. So they could be looking at references that are old and thinking that that's what applies now. So the internet is a really, really great thing, but needs to be viewed with a little bit of caution too. So it's a system problem, and we need to approach it from a system standpoint.
And then, Kyle, Lou, I think that this it really is a huge systems problem. And one of my favorite authors, his name is Malcolm Gladwell. And he actually writes for the New Yorker often. And one of his writings back in October of 2009 was titled Offensive Play. And I can send it to you so you can put it up as a link. And he really talks about professional football players. And what they started doing is taking those brains of those players after they've passed. And they looked at the brains of those football players and they said that it exactly mimicked the brain of someone with severe Alzheimer's because of these proteins that were building up within the brain itself. And it's really one of those articles that it talks about everything we're talking about, but it really hits home. And this is some of the things that I try to tell parents when they are in the ER, because people don't really realize what the long-term effect is on their child. But really, it's not really all the parents' fault. We have to really talk to the schools about it, talk to the coaches about it, educate the kids about it, so we can fix the system issue.
I feel sometimes that we're helpless when we do our standbys, because a lot of times we won't go out until we're called. They may have a trainer on the side. I think some of the trainers are good, but you have a lot of the old-time trainers, or you have the old-time docs. Where I grew up, the trainer for our football team was the old doc who still had his black bag, and the guy at that time in 1990 was probably about 80 years old. And I mean, he couldn't even walk up straight. You know, he was one of those. And you know, where's our responsibility? Where do we come in as pre-hospital providers in terms of protecting these children?
Well, there you get into the role of pre-hospital providers in injury prevention and public health. And I think you'll find that most pediatric-oriented folks are going to be all for anybody who can jump into the public health arena and injury prevention arena. And we speak about pre-hospital care providers as being in having an unusual opportunity to make a real impact, because they are where things happen. You know, these injuries don't happen while the kid is at the ER. Well, unless they fall off a stretcher or something, which happens every once in a while. But, you know, when you have folks who are out in the environment in which these things happen, whether it's head injuries or near drownings or any kind of preventable injury. And by the way, we're not going to call them accidents anymore, right? Because they're not acts of God. A lot of these things are preventable or predictable, and therefore they're not accidents. They're things that can be prevented. And I think EMS providers, even though it's not necessarily the best time right when an injury has occurred to try to educate parents, but if you're in that position where you're doing standbys and, you know, nobody's injured at the time, but you're there, that would be a great time if you have the right education yourself to take the opportunity to educate some other folks. So EMS providers, I think, really have a long way that they could step up into the public health role and really, really help out.
You know what, Lou, I agree with you 1,000%, and I think that I put this in the same category as EMS providers teaching the public about the new CPR guidelines. I mean,
yep.
It's you know, they're out there, they're viewed in the public. Little kids love to hear, to see a paramedic firefighter. I mean, this is something that I think should be really at the top of the job description list for someone in EMS, because that's what you guys are. You're educators. And I think that everyone should look at themselves like that.
And teaching CPR is great. We need CPR. CPR now actually is coming around to the point where it actually is saving a significant number of lives. But if EMS providers and those who support them, such as us, we who are medical directors and other medical professionals, could support EMS providers in their role in public health and injury prevention, think of how many more people you can affect in their lives and mitigate injury and future complications by doing things like head injury instruction and drowning prevention and bicycle helmets and all that kind of stuff. You're going to save a lot more lives and a lot more effective life years by doing that kind of stuff than you're ever going to do by teaching CPR.
Right. Yeah. You know what? And why not take a few guys from the station and head down to the local high school or head down to the local elementary school? We here down in Broward, here in Fort Lauderdale, we actually set up a coach symposium where we brought all these coaches on in, and we had many people. We had the pre-hospital people there. We had the physicians there. We had trainers there. And we really try to educate these coaches on how bad head injury can be. And it really, it's an eye-opener, and it's so nice to get them before it happens.
Russ, are you guys doing anything with preventive injury prevention at all?
Not right now, but it's actually there's actually a few plans in the works as far as prevention programs and outreach programs and stuff like that. We were actually talking about that today at work, about how we have a fire prevention, you know, division within the fire department, but we don't have an EMS education for the public, and how much it would benefit people if we, you know, could teach them how to do their own CPR and first aid and I said this, and it kind of ties into something I said on EMS Garage last week, is that we've pounded it into people's heads that whenever something, you know, bad happens, to call 911, and we've increased their, you know, reliance upon us to do something when something, you know, when something bad happens, essentially, that, you know, people and parents and everybody have forgotten, you know, basic parenting skills like home proofing and first aid and CPR at home in case of an emergency. And they, you know, they just expect to call 911 and get an immediate response that will, you know, solve all problems. And we've failed in an education role as far as teaching people how to, you know, do home proofing and stuff like that.
Great point. Couldn't agree with you more.
I think the one thing that we can really start looking at, especially as we start working towards springtime and summer, and I know a cause of head injuries is children without helmets on bicycles and all-terrain vehicles and such like that, that we should start, you know, using that. I think it's getting a little bit better. A lot of legislation has passed that requires children to wear helmets, but they still don't. So coming out and using that as a basis. What other injury prevention techniques can we do? Just brainstorming, do you think?
When I was in EMT school, actually, when I was in EMT basic, I had a teacher that was talking about something that the police started in the town that he worked in, that, you know, all the people, they always wanted to listen to the fire department, but the police department also got involved. And whenever they started seeing kids wearing bicycle helmets when they were out, they started handing out tickets for free ice cream. So, you know, whenever a police officer saw a kid wearing a bicycle or riding a bicycle wearing a helmet, they would hand out ice cream tickets.
That's a great idea.
That's positive enforcement. That helps. That's great. I always, whenever I get a kid coming in that should have been wearing a helmet, fell off a bike or something, I always ask them if they have a helmet. And inevitably, you know, if they weren't wearing a helmet, which if they were, generally they're not coming in for a head injury, but if they have a helmet, then I ask them, okay, so where is the helmet? Oh, it's in my closet. So when was the last time you saw a closet riding a bicycle? And they look at me like I'm really silly. I go, that helmet isn't doing anybody any good in that closet. And I said, you know what? The laws in Dade County say that children less than 15 years of age must be wearing a bike helmet if they're riding a bicycle on public property. So I've never had one come in to say that they had actually been given a ticket for not wearing a bicycle helmet, because I think sometimes the police feel so sorry that they've had an injury that they don't enforce that law. But anyway, I tell the kids, I say, listen, you know, next time you're riding around without a helmet, a cop sees it, they could stop you, they could give you that ticket, and that ticket costs, I think it's $75. I said, chances are your parents are going to have to pay that ticket, and that's $75 that they could have been spending on you for other good things.
75 ice cream cones.
Can you still get an ice cream cone anywhere for a buck?
Well, in Buffalo, if it's snowing, it's half price.
Oh, okay.
<Donald.
laughs> I think the other thing is look at, so sometimes when we do these standbys, we're kind of looked at as the quote-unquote trainer. It's getting better now. A lot of schools are required to have trainers, but some of these small rural areas do not have that ability, and they look at the EMS folks to be their trainers. So when we're assessing a kid post-head injury, when should we start saying this kid needs to go by ambulance to an ER, besides the obvious unconsciousness and seizing?
Well, at this point, it's recommended in, you know, the 2010 recommendations that any child who's been in a sporting event, has suffered any kind of concussive symptoms, that they not only be pulled out of a game, but they be evaluated by an appropriate medical professional before they resume play. Now, an appropriate medical professional, you know, for screening is an emergency physician, but for, you know, a real seriously good screening for neurological consequences of a concussion is a neurologist. And we all know pediatric neurologists grow on trees. They're so common. Mm-hmm. Not. But in general, if you have a child who has anything more than, you know, just a minute or a couple of minutes of concussive symptoms, any of those things that I read off the list there, they probably should be going to the ER for evaluation. Now, do they have to go by ambulance? Not necessarily, but you want to try to make sure that they get there.
That's going to be my next question. Do they need to go by EMS? And I kind of bring that by two reasons. One, sometimes the parents want to take them. But the second reason is, if my ambulance left my field, that game was stopping. Now, I understand, you know, in terms of injuries and such like that, you know, if it's a serious injury, you know, we're going to stop the game and go, and we'll get someone else coming in. But is it something that, you know, in the milder cases, that they can wait for another ambulance to come so we don't have to stop the game? Because I know that's going to be a question, or I guarantee someone out there that's listening to this is thinking that.
Right. I mean, I think that's a case-by-case scenario. I mean, obviously, not only head injury you have to worry about, but, of course, you have to worry about the spinal cord, the neck. So if you have a child who really cannot sit up on his own accord and just laying back there, and you have to come out onto the field and really kind of help that kid up, then, you know, in my opinion, if you're an EMS provider, you don't want to be a hero and just kind of come out there and say, he'll be okay and so forth. You really have to understand that this child may have some really major injury, whether it be spinal cord or head injury, that may not be readily apparent at the moment. You know, fortunately, with the helmets and so forth, you're not going to really see that type of injury that requires surgery at the moment. But I think that there are other injuries that you really have to be on the lookout for.
Now, earlier you had mentioned the fact about the young kids having potential concussions and brain injuries, especially the ones learning to walk and such. When would you even begin to suspect that at that age? And I'm even staying away from the 2-month-olds because we're not. Yeah, so we're staying away from that. But, you know, those young children, that 1, 1.5, 2, when they're starting to walk and move, what would even cross your mind that the kid had a concussion?
Well, you know, everybody, the first thing that comes to everybody's mind other than loss of consciousness is vomiting. Well, you know, there are some kids who vomit when you look at them crooked. And I think the literature is pretty good in supporting that, you know, a couple of vomits soon after the injury in a child who otherwise looks and is acting well is not anything of concern. Now, if it's been 4 hours, the kid hasn't vomited, and now all of a sudden starts vomiting, is complaining of a bad headache, or is acting like they're kind of out of balance, that's a whole different ball of wax. But the usual just 1-2 vomits short after the injury usually doesn't mean much of anything. But, you know, I hate to keep going back to the same old thing, but I don't, because it's such a good thing, and that's the PAT. So if that child is not interacting appropriately with the environment post a head injury, needs to be evaluated.
Yeah, and you know, yeah. I mean, listen, I think the exact same thing. I'm very happy that you mentioned the vomiting thing, because I can't tell you how many people see their kid vomited one time, and then they kind of rush in to get a CAT scan. I think that you know, we and Kyle, as far as your question is concerned, as far as the younger kids, you know, I don't think medicine is there yet with knowing how bad or how much of an additive effect those head injuries are having. But trust me, there's a lot of money being put into that type of medicine right now and looking for those biochemical markers, because, you know, concussion and head injury now is all the rage. And if people really knew what was happening to those football players, parents would never let their children play a contact sport. I mean, they even say that every time that the quarterback says "hut," and those linemen are kind of, their helmets are clicking together, that is another additive injury. Every time a soccer player heads the ball, they say on average, soccer players who head the ball lose 6 IQ points. So, you know, this is really serious stuff. And I think, unfortunately, not until we have a way to measure this type of injury is the public, and not even, you know, us folks in healthcare, really going to understand what type of damage is really happening. So, and plus, the NFL makes so much money that you clearly see how they're brushing everything under the rug, and they're talking about getting new helmets and this and that. But there's some serious data out there to really show how dangerous head injuries really are.
And, you know, it's really funny because, Peter, have you had parents who have come in and say, I don't know what's going on, but my kid is always falling and hitting his head. Is that a bad thing? And I used to think, no, it's just part of being a kid, you know, Charlie Brown syndrome, big, heavy head. They, you know, get out of balance. They fall and hit their head all the time. And as long as they're okay at the time, they're going to stay okay. But now I'm like those parents, and I'm starting to wonder, too. Is there something that we need to be doing? Is there something we need to be looking for these kids who had multiple head bumps, the little guys, even if they're looking perfectly fine to us now? You know, do we need to breed more pediatric neurologists so we have enough specialists to be doing all these head injury evaluations that it's starting to look like maybe we should be doing?
I can tell you a personal story that I have a little 2-year-old who's hit his head so many times I can't even count. And I can tell you that he's a pretty tough character. I mean, we're not sure if he just why he's so feisty, why he kind of cries all the time. And now that we're having this conversation, I wonder if that's probably one of the issues. But yeah, it's a question I don't think many of us can answer right now.
That's a good point. You know, I'm thinking more and more about this, and how many times my kid struck my head. And we kind of always joked about it, but it's getting kind of nerve wracking. You know, on that, you know, we're gonna have to put my head, you know, my kids in a big like Nerf helmet or something like that, walking around. So, if we do decide that this child is going to go via EMS, what should be some of the treatment and management besides spinal mobilization, if the mechanism matches? What should be some of the some of the treatment options we should be looking at with these patients?
I think in the pre-hospital arena. If you're dealing with some type of head injury that is a surgical type of head injury where you know this child may have a significant spinal cord injury or he does have an epidural, you know, I think those kids you have to be really careful with. And, you know, we talk about the whole issue about backboarding, you know, kids. The other day they brought me this 14-year-old kid with a known epidural. They were transporting him from another facility to me. And he came in kind of strapped on his back. His head was kind of taped down to the backboard. And we know that if you have an epidural hematoma, you should probably be elevated 30 degrees and so forth. But so sometimes all those kind of rules and regulations may not be the best thing. But I think for now, all we have is really immobilize them appropriately, you know, on the field, transport them. And in the ER, it's not really that we do much for them, except evaluate them, just like Lou said earlier, with a good neurologic exam. For those kids who need other things, and you want to start talking about hypothermia, pre-hospital, and so forth, I guess that's a whole other topic. But for the most part, I think just appropriate transfer and rapid transfer to the ER for an evaluation.
And you do need to be cognizant of what your community resources are and what the capabilities are. So if you have, say, two hospitals available to you, and one of them is a little bit more of a pediatric center than the other one, then, you know, if you have a choice, you want to go to that pediatric center. Because if you have a child with a head injury, number one, if it's something that is, you know, truly potentially catastrophic and might need neurosurgery, then it's best if that kid can be gotten to that resource as soon as possible and not make a stop in between. So that's one of those things where EMS providers are going to need to be responsible for knowing what their community's resources are, what their alternatives are for transport and transport destinations. Because one of the best things that you can do for that kid is to get them to the right place the first time.
And that's a huge point, Lou. And medicine is going that way. We all know that for STEMIs, we go to a PCI center. For strokes, we go to a stroke center. And a lot of people forget about that, that in pediatrics, you really need to go to the right place. And that's a great point.
Yeah, one of the slogans that's going around right now with regard to pediatric specialty care is the right place. Oh, gosh. Oh, now I just forgot it. The right place in the right time with the right people. So, you know, you're going to where the kid needs to go from the very start.
And the other thing that you need to be aware of, Dr. Antov, you kind of brought it up about the transport, you know, bringing the head up about, you know, 30 degrees. But you also need to really talk to your driver. on this, and you don't want to be slamming on the brakes and hitting gas real quick, because then you start moving the blood forward and backward on that. If you're doing flight medicine, if you're new to flight medicine, you understand when you fly in a helicopter, you're actually flying nose down. So you really need to make sure you bring that stretcher up. Otherwise, you're going to have that person in an unintended Trendelenburg position on that. So be aware of that. Be aware of how your ambulance is being driven and operating, and watch the G-forces, because those all play a role in the circulatory aspect of the body. So be aware of that as well.
Great point.
Yeah, I think we really forget about that, the stressors of transfer. Okay, so that's the obvious one. That's from the sports injury. But, you know, let's say that you get called to the house. I mean, is there really much we're going to do, you know, for this? You know, we're called to the house, you know, after the game. The kid's there, and he's kind of drowsy. And mom looks at him and says, he's just not himself. He's kind of drowsy. He got hit in the head, you know, last night in the game, and just been kind of sleepy ever since.
No, there's not much you're going to do except to advise and or facilitate transport to that right place.
What about oxygenation? I know there's a lot of controversy and stuff, you know, about applying oxygen and stuff. Have you guys seen much in terms of that with head injuries?
I think that overall oxygen is bad for anything, for any. I'm not sure if there's any real data on this. This particular matter, but I can tell you that whenever you have tissue that's hurting, that's not doing well, and you flood it with oxygen, and you
free radicals,
boy, yeah, that's going to be, you know, I think in the next 5 years, when the 2015 guidelines come out, it's going to be, you know, very limited oxygen for anything.
I mean, you know, if they're already saturating 95% or above, they've got adequate, maybe not maximal, but they've probably got adequate oxygenation, and you don't need to add oxygen on top of that.
Now, this kind of goes back to something that you mentioned earlier, Dr. Antevi, about, you know, they may be breathing 3 times a minute, but, you know, and their sats is 100%, but they're becoming hypercarbic. I don't think we can go on much more on this podcast without talking about secondary brain injuries for that, because that's something that we actually play a direct role in. So when do we consider, you know, oxygenation? When do we consider ventilation on these head injuries, so we don't cause secondary brain injuries?
Yeah, well, I think again, it's probably a case by case issue. But, you know, really in the pre-hospital environment, if you have a kid that has a head injury and you're transporting him and you realize that his left pupil is blown and he's kind of not really with the program, and you want to consider, you're probably bagging him already, and maybe consider maybe a short period of hyperventilation. But I think that, you know, that again, it's that's kind of like realizing that you're, if you're in a situation where a child is about to go down on you and about to herniate, that's when I think you really need to intervene as far as your bagging is concerned. Yeah, again, oxygenation, I think, is probably lesser of a point in that situation,
and hopefully, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Russell.
As far as ventilation, and we can use waveform capnography to measure that ventilation, you know, issue. As far as what numbers are we kind of looking for when we're ventilating patients using waveform capnography? Should we maintain them within the normal level, or should they be slightly lower or slightly higher? And this is something that we've been discussing around here, as far as, you know, what are our other uses for capnography, as far as intubation place, as far as intubation confirmation, and you know, whether or not we should be using CPAP or not. What are some other uses that we can use to squeeze the most function that we can out of this tool? And that was something that I brought up, is using it to titrate the amount of CO2 in the bloodstream, you know, for a head injury, and what kind of numbers are we looking for?
And we were on the same page, because I was just going to bring up the capnometry. You know, it used to be that we would hyperventilate all head injuries that, you know, had enough alteration in mental status that they needed assisted ventilation, and we just sort of guessed, and sometimes we just bagged them all at 40. But now with the capno, you know, we found out that with this full-scale hyperventilation that we used to do for the bad head injuries, that we were driving the CO2 down so far that we were actually causing constriction of the cerebral blood vessels.
Right.
And that made it so that you didn't have enough cerebral perfusion pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't enough blood getting up into the brain, which meant there wasn't enough blood pressure, there wasn't enough oxygen, there wasn't enough glucose, and CO2 wasn't being taken away from the brain cells adequately. So we were actually causing more harm than good with the extreme hyperventilation. And now that we've got the capnometers, we have a much better way of gauging exactly what we're doing with regard to the ventilation in particular. And people really need to start thinking about oxygenation and ventilation as two separate processes. Mm-hmm. You're managing them both at the same time, but you've got different goals for each one of those processes. If you have a patient who has an alteration in mental status after head injury who requires bagging but is not at that point where Peter was talking about of impending herniation, you want to keep them with a normal CO2. So you want to keep their CO2 in the low 40s, high 30s. But if you've got that kid or adult, for that matter, who is getting ready to crash, who's getting ready to herniate, they've blown a pupil, you're noting Cushing's triad, so the patient is hypertensive, bradycardic, has irregular or absent respirations, that's the patient that you want to intentionally hyperventilate. But you don't want to take them much more further down than about the mid-30s. So below that, you're possibly fighting yourself by blowing off that much CO2. So you don't want to go down much below about 35.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Dr. Anthony.
The only one thing I wanted to comment on, you know, I think Lou said it perfectly, but to Russell's comment that the capnometers, you really have to be careful because they are not going to give you oftentimes the actual number. In other words, if you start a patient off and he's at your actual reading starts at 20, for example, then you have to use that as your baseline. So a lot of people think that, oh my God, if this thing doesn't read 35 in a normal patient, then this can't be true. And you have to understand how these capnometers work. And I'm sure that as we get more experience with them, people will realize that it's not the absolute number that we're looking for. And sometimes it's hard when you're looking at a number that's not the number you think you should see, but it's actually just to be used as a baseline so that if that number goes up or down, you can say, hey, this is different than what I was looking at 5 minutes ago.
And that's what I was going to kind of lead into as well, is talking about, you know, you have to make sure that you've got perfusion to the lungs, and that can cause one of your biggest issues. If you have a hypotensive patient, your end-tile numbers will be lower than what you would suspect.
Right.
Yeah.
For that. So that's a big thing. It's a tool, but folks, all these are great tools, but you still have to look at your patient.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
And judge your treatment on that patient. They're great tools, but still look at your patient. Don't fall into that trap.
Now, Kyle, the other thing, the other vital function that we need to talk about is circulation.
Absolutely.
And it used to be everybody was saying, okay, fluid restriction on patients with head injuries. So don't give them any IV fluids. Well, if you have a multi-system trauma patient who has an abdominal injury and is bleeding into their belly and is hypotensive, but at the same time has a head injury, you've got to give that patient fluids because you've got to preserve the circulation to that brain for all the reasons that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is no longer this whole scale forbidding of giving IV fluids to patients with head injuries. It's much better for them to be normotensive. You don't want them hypertensive, but at least try to get them normotensive in order to make sure that there is blood going to that brain. Because if you don't have blood going to that brain, you know, what you might be getting back is an organ donor. Okay, well, that's good for society too, but you really want to set your goals higher than that.
Right, and also, Lou, I agree with you 100%, and just to further the point with if you're really going to get that detailed with those type of patients, intubation of the head injured patient is not an easy thing. Although they have great airways and their lungs are working perfectly, they're usually a quote-unquote easy intubation. But you have to remember, you're giving them oftentimes a benzo, which is lowering their blood pressure, which is lowering the cerebral perfusion pressure. That's number one. Then you're shoving this big honking tube down their trachea, and perhaps you have not given lidocaine as a pre-medication. And then you're going to create a lot of pain because this tube's sitting in their throat. And then their pressure is going to go really high, and you're going to cause them to herniate. So it's really a lot of times not what we need to do, but what we have to make sure that we do not do for these patients, which is we shouldn't do any harm to our patients in the pre-hospital environment And I think that intubation is really a critical item with pain control and sedation. And oftentimes, we don't give our pre-hospital providers those tools to successfully intubate these head injured patients for a good outcome.
I think one of my favorite lines as a flight medic was, put the tube down. I'd walk in and they're trying to shove a blade down this person's throat who's trying to bite down on it. I'm like, you're making it worse. You're making this whole situation worse. You're increasing your ICP. And going back to the whole thing with the circulation is, folks, you have to overcome the ICP to have pressure going up into the head. As that ICP increases, you have to increase your perfusion pressure. And have you guys heard anything about MAPS in terms of that? I know we're getting a lot into, the mean arterial pressures and stuff. Have you heard much in terms of pediatric MAPS with head injuries?
Not me.
No.
Can't really. Okay. No.
I think
the question, Kyle, about, Peter's great point about intubation and the procedures themselves having potential negative consequences for the patient, we need to get away from thinking in terms of procedures and start thinking about physiology. We need physiologic goals, not procedural goals. The goal has to be to maintain oxygenation at this particular functional level, the CO2 at this particular functional level, perfusion at this level, and stop thinking in terms of putting a plastic cylinder down an organic tube. The procedure is not to put a tube down somebody's trachea, but to obtain adequate oxygenation and ventilation. And then that frees up your alternatives, so you can say, okay, these are ways that I can attain these physiological goals. Which of these is going to attain those goals while being safest for my patient?
Absolutely. Now, of course, the last one I've got to bring up, because I hear this so often when I'm out teaching, especially in the adult population. The one thing I always tell everybody is when you have a patient with an altered mental status, there's one, we go through AEIOU tips and all the possible causes of an altered mental status, and that one in there is insulin. And the one thing I've always hammered on, if you have somebody with an altered mental status, I don't care the mechanism or what, check that glucose.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear all too often from providers, you can't give a head injured patient glucose.
Baloney.
It drives me nuts. I don't know where this... where did this come from?
Well, it comes, I think, probably from the diabetics and DKA and high glucoses causing changes in the tonicity and fluid shifts and blah, blah, blah. And there's no question that too much glucose is not good for the brain, but too little glucose is far worse. The brain has to have fuel to work. So if there's no fuel, then the brain is going to suffer no matter how good your oxygenation and ventilation is. So you want to make sure, just like with O2 and CO2, you want it to be adequate. Not hyper, but adequate.
Excellent. Well, we're just pulling up on about an hour. That was a great conversation. I really appreciate it for that. And, folks, when you are... looking at these sporting events, when you're at these sporting events, if you're with your own kids, you have to be aware that, that brain sloshes around in there, and a little bit of damage, as we talked about tonight, could be leading to a lot of these other issues that we're facing. And maybe we should start kind of having a higher index of suspicion. Maybe we need to start to be more proactive in terms of injury prevention on this. So we, before we sign off tonight, I just want to thank Russ, thank you so much for joining us. Where can we find you?
The blog, hybridmedic.com, and on Twitter, hybridmedic, and Facebook, hybridmedic blog. And of course there's my regular Facebook page, but not very many people pay attention to that anyway, so
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Russ.
Huh?
Dr. Antevi, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Hantevi, which is HANDTEVY. I have a Facebook page, which is Pediatric Emergency Standards Incorporated. And happy to be here, and thanks again for the invite.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening. And Dr. Liu.
Well, I think I have a Twitter address, EPC. EPC.med, but I don't do much with it. I do have a Facebook page, just Lou Romig. But the best way to get a hold of me is just to email me at louromig@bellsouth.net or check out my website at jumpstarttriage.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Kyle David Bates. You can find me at here at PDU.com. You can find me over at my website, KyleDavidBates.com, on Twitter at ImageMedic. You can also find me over at my other project, FirstFewMoments.com as well, where we talk about managing the scene of a motor vehicle crash, and we are actually going to be heading to Fairbanks in a few weeks, taking that course on the road. So, folks, when you encounter that pediatric head-injured patient, no matter the tools you have to look at the patient, do an assessment. And as we talked about, the signs and symptoms could be something very, very simple. It may just be that they may be sad, they may be irritable, they may not be able to concentrate too well. They may have a headache. It may go so far as to be what we consider a severe head injury. But a lot of times, as we're finding out through research and literature, that maybe a lot of these kids who are hitting their heads, even when they're learning to walk, are suffering from some sort of a traumatic brain injury and concussion. So be proactive out there. Take your time. Look at your kids. Do the assessment. And, you know, for goodness sake, be an advocate for the child. If you see something that doesn't seem to fit at a sporting event and you're doing a standby, go up and talk to the coach, talk to the parent, and maybe talk to the child. And maybe this child should be evaluated before they return to play. So for my panel and for me and the PDU podcast, I thank you for joining us tonight. And stay safe out there. And, you know, they're little adults, but, you know, at the same time, they're not so little adults. Have a good night. To you as long as I can.